For NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents around the globe. I'm Douglas Roberts. This week, Russian troops at war in Georgia, American Special Forces train commandos in Afghanistan, and conflict disrupts life in the Switzerland of Asia. Throughout the week, NPR's Ivan Watson reported on the war between Russia and the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. Initially, the fighting was confined to breakaway parts of Georgia that have significant Russian populations. But as the conflict dragged on, Russian forces moved deeper into Georgia. When they seized the town of Gori on Monday, they effectively cut Georgia in half. Watson was there to chronicle the Georgian retreat.
This afternoon, Georgian tanks rumbled through Gori's all but deserted streets. Their treads echoed through a central square where a statue of Joseph Stalin stands in memory of this town's most infamous son. Gori is just 20 miles from South Ossetia, the breakaway region where this savage little war erupted just a few days ago. Georgian troops stormed that Russian-backed separatist region on Thursday, but then Russian warplanes retaliated by attacking Georgian soldiers in South Ossetia and bombing other targets around Georgia, including Gori. On Sunday, Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili pulled his troops out of South Ossetia and has since made repeated appeals for a ceasefire. Saakashvili briefly visited Gori today wearing a camouflage flak jacket. He was accompanied by Bernard Kouchner, the foreign minister of France, who traveled to the region to try to hammer out a ceasefire agreement.
Did you have any luck today?
Yes, we had some luck here, yes. But this is just the beginning. Having luck on one side doesn't mean anything if you have no luck on the other side. So we'll go to Moscow now, we'll see.
Before leaving for Russia for more talks, the French diplomat visited a hospital in Gori where he spoke with this Georgian doctor.
And in terms of drugs and perfusion, etc., you have enough?
So far so good, but probably in a few days or a week from now we won't have anything. We need your help.
With fears of a possible Russian invasion looming, some of the residents here weren't reaching out to Western countries for help. They turned to a higher power. 23-year-old Ketivan Vatyashvili stopped into this tiny church on a windy hilltop to pray for peace in her town.
I came here to this church to pray because I really believe that God can survive us because it's a very, very dangerous situation.
As she spoke, a deadly artillery duel broke out on the flat plain below, which separated Gori from Russian troops in South Ossetia. At one point, a fleet of 7 attack helicopters suddenly roared overhead and raced towards the battlefield. They circled and strafed the ground in a flash of fire and smoke before pulling back just a few minutes later. Then, without any explanation, word suddenly spread that the Georgian army was retreating from Gori. These Georgian soldiers yelled, "Get out of here before you get killed," as they hastily climbed on board a military truck.
We've been racing down the highway, fleeing the town of Gori, along with dozens and dozens of vehicles, many of them army trucks loaded with soldiers. Many of these are civilian vehicles with soldiers hanging on to them, hanging onto the sides, soldiers piled up into the back of pickup trucks. I've never seen anything like this. It appears to be a very haphazard retreat from the strategic town of Gori. After just a few days of fighting with the Russian army, the faces of these Georgian soldiers are very dejected. Some of them are crossing themselves as they are in full flight from the town that they were supposed to be defending.
Ivan Watson, NPR News, Gori, Georgia.
When the U.S. military attacked Afghanistan in late 2001, it was Special Forces units that spearheaded the overthrow of the Taliban. In the 7 years since, these American commandos have been continually rotating into Afghanistan to fight what has become a tough and protracted battle against the Taliban and other Islamist militants. Now, the Special Forces are involved in an ambitious training project that is expected to pay dividends in the counterinsurgency struggle. NPR's Jackie Northam spent 10 days with the special forces, and this is the first of her two reports.
Like most other destinations in Afghanistan, the best, fastest way to reach Camp Moorhead is by helicopter. The military base sits in a low valley surrounded by the rugged, bald mountains that dominate the landscape in eastern Afghanistan. From the air, you can see the military base that has been occupied by various forces over the years, the Russians and the Taliban included. Now, the U.S. Special Forces are the primary tenants at Camp Moorhead. They're using it as a training camp for Afghan Army commandos. Two lines of Afghan soldiers from the 209th Army Corps march lockstep along the camp's dusty, unpaved roads. They are the latest of five battalions that have passed through the camp since training began in early spring 2007. Each Afghan battalion averages about 650 commandos. At the moment, they are being trained by the 7th Special Forces Group out of Fort Bragg, with help from other commandos from France and the United Arab Emirates. The U.S. Special Forces launched the Afghan commando program for several reasons. In part, it's what they do, train indigenous forces. It was also created in an effort to help the ANA, Afghanistan's conventional army, says Colonel Sean Mulholland, the commander of the Combined Joint Special Operations Task Force in Afghanistan.
The Afghan government wanted to develop a ranger-like or a special ops-like structure in the military, but they need a smaller, more agile, flexible force. And so the commandos was the solution.
Mulholland says the Afghan Special Forces are critical to the broader counterinsurgency effort in Afghanistan. They're trained to ambush or attack militant hideouts and bomb-making facilities, to capture or kill insurgents, and to try to build a rapport with people in the villages where Islamist militants are present. For the new Afghan commando recruits, Camp Moorhead is the first stop.
This is the Commando Training Company compound. This is where all the students live for the 12 weeks that they're here.
A trim 35-year-old major in the Special Forces commands a training center. He, like others of his rank or below, are not allowed to identify themselves to reporters for security reasons. He says the Afghan commandos are trained in 7 specialty platoons, including mortars, reconnaissance, and signals.
This is the medical platoon.
Afghan soldiers here practice administering IVs, tying tourniquets, and performing CPR. Specialty platoons such as this are taught by U.S. contractors.
These guys are ready to be evaluated. Amada?
Amada.
Okay, your patient's not breathing. Go.
Two Afghan soldiers quickly try to resuscitate the mock patient, counting slowly as they force air down its throat. The U.S. will feed, clothe, and equip the fledgling Afghan commandos. They advise, organize, and oversee the project. But it's the Afghans who take the lead in the training, teaching military skills, tactics, and strategy. Dozens of commando recruits sit on a dirt patch, seeking shelter from the ferocious midday sun and listening intently to their Afghan trainer, who himself was trained in Jordan. The commandos wear green helmets and carry American-made M4 assault rifles. Many have beards, which local custom allows. They come from all parts of the country, reflecting Afghanistan's vast ethnic makeup. The trainer talks to his troops about their cordon and search exercise at a mock village nearby and tells them about camouflage techniques. Many of the Afghan soldiers are already battle-hardened by the time they come to the commando camp. Command Sergeant Major Fayez Mohammed is 27 years old. He's been in the Army most of his adult life. He's also been shot 7 times in combat. He's one of the commando recruits who has excelled. Soon, he'll be sent to the U.S., first for English classes, then to Army Ranger School. Mohammed says the commando training program represents a new start for Afghanistan's Army.
Special Force guys teach me. He teach the fight. The Special Force guys teach the course of actions. Everything's we're ready.
Once the Afghan commandos finish their initial training, they're assigned to a battalion of the National Army. But they soon rotate back into U.S. training camps for another 6 weeks to help them expand and sharpen their skills in courses like this mock ambush exercise. By this point in their training, the Afghan commandos are considered operational. They regularly go out on missions with the U.S. Special Forces. Captain Harzamir is the commander of the 2nd Commando Company on rotation at the base. He says his men are well prepared for any assault mission.
We are here as a QRF, a quick reaction force. We are doing operations in 4 different provinces around here. We can get ready in 20 to 25 minutes and can stop any kind of bad activities.
The majority of the commandos who go out on assault missions now are Afghan. They outnumber the American Special Forces by about 4-1. The 29-year-old U.S. detachment commander at this base is a captain in the Green Berets. He says the Afghans have an inherent and invaluable knowledge of the terrain and the language.
I think that's why the commandos are so important, because, again, they are Afghans. They understand the culture, they understand the country, they understand the history. They can interact with the population in a way that no outsider ever could.
But they're also not ready to stand up on their own right now, says Colonel Mulholland, commander of all special operations forces in Afghanistan.
You need to feed them. You need to resupply them. You need to give them equipment. You need to give them mobility, cars, trucks, helicopters. There's a lot of pieces that we're missing here still.
Somewhere down the line, it's hoped the Afghan commandos will be able to provide relief to U.S. Special Forces, which are feeling the strain from constant tours of duty in Afghanistan. But Mulholland predicts the American elite fighting force will be here for years to come.
After an initial 3-month training course, the new Afghan commandos regularly go on often dangerous missions with the Green Berets. Northam accompanied them on one of these joint missions, an air assault on a suspected Taliban hideout.
It's shortly after 3:00 in the morning at Kandahar Airfield. A sergeant first class with the U.S. Special Forces tries to organize nearly 2 dozen Afghan commandos, even where they'll be sitting on a large Chinook helicopter.
You sit right there. Your RTO, where's the RTO? Right here. Your RTO will sit right next to you. Okay.
In a little over an hour, a team of U.S. and Afghan special forces will begin an operation, an air assault, on a suspected Taliban hideout. It's one of many joint missions that have been conducted over the past year. The American sergeant knows it's well worth rehearsing the drill over and over.
Hey, you're going to get a 5-minute, 3-minute, and 1-minute call.
3-1.
Yeah. All right. So at the five minutes, so relay. Okay. 3 minutes. 1 minute. Undo your seatbelts.
The American sergeant, who cannot be identified to reporters under the rules of the Special Forces, says he wants to make sure all involved, particularly the Afghan commandos, know what they're expected to do once they hit their target area.
Commandant said, Bashir. Okay, what's going on now? Birds landed, we're off, what's going on?
This operation was several weeks in the making, but the small village of Zargaron in the southeastern province of Zabul has been under surveillance much longer, says this Special Forces captain, who's the commander of this joint operation.
Some of our intel assessment that we have on this particular area is a known way station, a known waypoint for IED facilitators in the area.
Bomb makers,
yes, ma'am.
The captain says the Islamist militants often pass through Zargaron. 2 key Taliban leaders are suspected of being in the tiny village at the moment. The commandos are expecting a fight. Still, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Karsner, the U.S. Special Forces commander in Kandahar, says it will be a standard operation going in.
A mission which is going to be short duration, highlighted by speed of execution, violence of action, well-coordinated plan, and a planned withdrawal. We're not going to stay there and hold ground.
Shortly before the mission gets underway, a Predator, an unmanned surveillance plane, quietly takes off from Kandahar Airfield and heads to the Zargaron area. The U.S. and Afghan commando teams put on heavy armored vests, helmets, ballistic eyeglasses, and pick up their American-made weapons. The U.S. team is bristling with communication devices. Team members pause before heading to the Chinook helicopter.
Give us wisdom to see the things that possibly we may not always see, to make the right decisions, watch over the commandos, and help us to lead and guide them. Be with their families as they're back home, give them a peace as we're out.
Hey, let me know.
the helicopters lift off from the Kandahar Air Base and head to Zargaran. They stop halfway, where more choppers carrying regular Afghan army soldiers join the operation. The choppers twist and turn through the imposing mountain ranges. At times, you can almost reach out and touch the rocky peaks on either side. Helicopters are the best, in some cases the only way to reach remote villages, because the roads are so bad and the Taliban has spotters all along the way. The Joint Special Forces tried to drive to Zargaran about a month ago. After 12 hours, they had to turn back because of the terrain. This time, after a 40-minute flight, the commando's chopper touches down on a patch of dry earth overlooking Zargaran. It's just before 8 o'clock in the morning. The mission has begun. The commandos spill out of the back of the helicopter and quickly get into position. The first minutes of the assault operation are considered critical. One group of commandos sets up heavy machine guns on a ridge overlooking the village to cover for the other special forces fanning out in the village below. Two Apache helicopter gunships roar through the valley, bank hard, and circle back over the village, providing more cover for the Afghan and U.S. Special Forces now leapfrogging from one building to another. The U.S. commander there stays on the ridge, watching over the unfolding operation.
What they're shooting at is basically sending some warning shots in the general direction of about 12 personnel that are massing on a hilltop.
The dozen people on the hill scatter at the sound of the gunfire. In the meantime, the Afghan interpreter is picking up communications between militants using walkie-talkies. The chatter on the radio indicates that the militants are still in the area and were very near a weapons cache in the village already discovered by the commandos.
They got ICOM chatter stating that reinforcements are able to come and reinforce here. And there's a Taliban commander saying, nah, don't go down in the village, that they, meaning us, is still here. But apparently there's someone inside the village still reporting out.
After a couple of hours, the commandos have cleared all the houses and rounded up about a dozen people, but no Taliban leaders. The commander and his group of commandos make their way into the village. This team meets up with another Special Forces group.
What's up, dude?
Hey, they're just finishing up top. They got maybe 3 minutes on top.
The two groups compare notes.
Hey, the one guy gave us where we found that cache. There was 12 foreign fighters there this morning, Chechen and Arab. They left right at daybreak.
Our guys said the same thing.
Same thing, yeah.
That they had Chechens. He wasn't really sure. He said he didn't understand their language, what they were speaking.
So we probably missed them by about an hour and a half, 2 hours.
The two Special Forces captains say it's not unusual for the militants to leave for another village at daybreak. But they say finding the weapons cache will disrupt the network and show the militants that no place is beyond the reach of the commandos.
Have a good one. Be safe.
Thank you.
Take care of them.
The two groups split up again, making their way to the landing site where the helicopters will carry them back to Kandahar. They'd like to be out of the region by noon because the choppers are needed for another mission. Jackie Northam, NPR News, in southern Afghanistan.
Coming up, how war came to the Swat Valley of Pakistan.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Douglas Roberts. The future of Pakistan's president, Pervez Musharraf, is in the news again. There are reports the general will resign soon rather than face impeachment. Musharraf's fate is causing feverish excitement in the capital, Islamabad, but many Pakistanis have more pressing concerns. NPR's Philip Reeves has been to the Swat Valley in Pakistan's northwest, scene of daily conflict between Islamist militants and the Pakistani army. This is the first of his two reports.
Dr. Zahid Hussain cannot sleep. He cannot work. He cannot concentrate. He gestures at the aging stethoscope on the desk of his cramped, ramshackle surgery. That's no use anymore, he says. He can't hear properly, as he has a perforated eardrum. A few months back, the doctor was caught up in a suicide bombing. 50 people died in that attack.
Mentally, I am depressed due to this scene and these incidents and this trauma.
I'm in grief. I'm in strong grief.
The attack happened at the funeral of the doctor's son-in-law, a policeman blown up by the Taliban earlier that day. Among the dead was the doctor's 20-year-old grandson. Hussein, a worn-looking man in his mid-60s, is confused. He can't figure out why people are doing this to his community.
I don't know what they want here. They're killing the people. I don't know. I don't understand their aim.
That community is a city called Mingora in Pakistan's Swat Valley. Before the trouble started, the valley attracted tourists from far and wide. The local people call it the Switzerland of Asia. You can fish for trout surrounded by peach orchards and poplar trees. You can even ski. But war has crept down from the nearby mountains, the tribal areas bordering Afghanistan, and into the valley. The Taliban is here, and so is the Pakistan army. They're both causing havoc. Zahid Khan is sitting in the courtyard of his fancy hotel. Tea is served by the one waiter still on his books. Khan says all the others have been sent home.
How many guests do you have now in this hotel?
There are no guests this year.
Khan heads the Swat Hotel Association. He says 75% of Swat Valley's nearly 900 hotels and restaurants are now closed. Tens of thousands of people are out of work. Many have left. Yet, says Khan's business partner, Mohammed Ibrahim, when you start talking about whose fault this is, people are frightened.
Because if any person says something, there is no life protection for him.
People are afraid.
People are afraid, definitely.
Are you afraid?
Yes, me too.
Last year, Pakistan's government sent the army into Swat to clear out the Taliban. After months of fighting, a peace agreement was struck in May, but it fell apart. So the army's launched what it calls the second phase of its operation against the militants.
Maulana Sufi Muhammad Sahib ki.
This is their opponent. His name is Mullah Fazlullah, and he's the leader of the Taliban in Swat Valley. Many just call him the FM Mullah.
He was assigned this task to make trouble in this area.
Ziauddin Yousafzai is a Swat resident and a leading peace activist.
He availed the opportunity of running an FM channel where he spoke in Pashto. And all other channels in this area, they are in Urdu or in English. So especially the women folk, they were his listeners.
The FM Mullah's men have attacked music and barber shops and torched nearly 100 girls' schools. They regularly assassinate government and security officials. Sajjad Khan, the local police chief, acknowledges he's a likely target himself.
Police has been the main target of the militants since we are the symbol of the threat of the government, threat of the state.
The army imposes a curfew every night and at times in the day, further damaging the economy. It's been bombarding militant positions in villages, sometimes killing civilians with stray shells. The people of Swat are religiously conservative and, like the Taliban, Pashtuns. Those brave enough to talk will tell you they despise both sides in this conflict, especially the army. Estimates vary over how much of Swat Valley is in Taliban hands. The police say it's roughly 15%. Others say it's more. There's something else the people of Swat will tell you. Conspiracy theories abound in this part of the world, and here many are convinced that Pakistan's security agencies are covertly encouraging war and working with the Taliban. Peace campaigner Ziauddin Yousafzai says both sides are playing a game in which they contrive to keep fighting to ensure the US keeps paying Pakistan hundreds of millions of dollars every month. He says American financial support is not the solution.
It is the most corrupting force. It is the most corrupt because then the target of the army is not peace, is not the elimination of terrorism. Their target is to show to Americans that we are using our gunships, we are firing mortars, and your money is being used.
Yousafzai says the effect of this game on the community is devastating.
There is only one business, and that is war business. All other businesses are gone.
Philip Reeves, NPR News.
A provincial official in northwest Pakistan says more than 200,000 people have been displaced by fighting between government forces and Islamist militants in the Bajur tribal area bordering Afghanistan. This is far from the only Pakistani region paralyzed by conflict. It has also wrecked the economy of Pakistan's most popular tourist area, the Swat Valley. NPR's Philip Reeves has just been to Swat. He found people there are frightened, deeply resentful of both the army and the Taliban, and, as he describes in this report, worried about their children.
The school day is beginning. Dozens of fresh-faced kids line up in the courtyard for the morning assembly. They honor their God. Then they honor their nation. This small school is in Swat Valley's main city, Mingora. Standing to attention in their crisp blue uniforms, the girls sing Pakistan's national anthem. At least they still get to go to school. Many girls in this valley do not. Not far away, Principal Wahida Begum is sitting behind a desk in the courtyard of her girls' school. She's stubbornly awaiting the arrival of her students. The other day, her school was firebombed by the Taliban. Akhalzada, the caretaker, was there when the militants arrived at 2 a.m. He shows us the blackened science laboratory.
Well, they came through the door on this side. They entered here. They asked me to stay away, and then they started burning the school. They had machine guns with them.
The school day should have begun here at least an hour ago. So far, only 20 girls have turned up. The rest, some 480 of them, are staying away. Begum says she's asked her handful of staff, all of whom are women, to help her keep the school going, no matter how few students they have. Almost 100 girls' schools in Swat Valley have been firebombed by the Taliban in little more than a year. Hotelier Ibrahim Mohammed says the local people don't know what to do.
They are powerless. What they do? They are only condemning. You know that in Islam, what Islam told us, acquired knowledge is incumbent upon every Muslim man and woman. So how we should against it, that the women should not get education after tomorrow we will burn their schools?
Ibrahim has daughters.
The day before yesterday, I heard that their school was burned. Somebody burns their school. Fortunately, they were not present at that time in the school.
That must be very worrying for you, though.
Yes, definitely.
He's not the only one who's worried.
I brought my kids here from England, and we are at the moment here. This is my country, and I cannot leave from here just because, you know, they want me to change my life.
Mechanical engineer Umar Hayat Khan came home to Swat recently after 18 years working in Britain. He's found school places for his two girls. He hopes the Taliban won't interfere.
This is a big worry, because without education, our children cannot grow, you know, in a situation like this.
The 1.7 million people of Swat Valley are almost all Pashtuns, the same ethnic group as the Taliban. They're conservative Muslims, but they stress this doesn't mean they do not value education. They point out that before 1969, Swat was a semi-autonomous princely state ruled by a progressive monarch, the Wali of Swat, who supported education for both sexes. Many here are outraged by the Taliban's attacks. They include Ziauddin Yousafzai, a peace campaigner who's also a school principal.
How can we think of ignoring half of our population to make them, to keep them illiterate and ignorant?
Yousafzai says the Taliban militants cannot justify their strategy, although they try to.
What they say usually, which I have heard from them, they say that it spreads vulgarity and obscenity in the society. When you educate a girl, she becomes able to write to someone. She becomes able to use mobiles, internet, and these things.
The Taliban are living in mountains and bunkers.
You can speak to the local Taliban spokesman in English by telephone, though today the line's poor. His name is Muslim Khan. He says the Taliban attacks government girls' schools because it views the syllabus as un-Islamic. Such arguments won't wash with Wahida Begum, the principal whose school was firebombed. She'll be there every day at her desk in the courtyard, waiting with her staff for the rest of her girls to return. We're not afraid, she says. We're in God's hands. Philip Reeves, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Roberts.